last time.
The question every morning is, will he make it or no? So sorry, always says. Dirtish forgot to tell you something quite important, and that is that very recently the New Path won the National Book Award for.
This is a very big award. Okay, sit down. Take a load off my feet. Well, when I first heard the news that we were not going to be here anymore, the new word in the English language sprang to my lips, supersuffragilistical. What a great, how terribly atrocious. This has never been my favorite venue. First of all, I can't see you. And I hate nodding my head affirmatively at an empty chair. So anyway, I think you'll like the new ashram. It's quite beautiful. It's not nearly so big, but I think that may be a good thing. Anyway, I would like to begin with a song. And this song is called Emerald Isle. Are you there? Thank you.
I'm here.
Yes. And let me take a swig of something hot here. Come here while I sing you of emerald hills, of valleys and meadows so fair that all who have seen them have carried away memories in their hearts, friends. Like the lilacs of May. My song is the story of the lilacs of May. My song is the story of deer on the hills, of larks that soar seeking the sun, of nightingales lifting the curtain of night, as with music they bring down heaven's blessing of light. Oh, my song is the story of God's blessing of light. Come join me in singing of that emerald isle, of flowers that like jewels sprinkle the knee, of waterfalls eager to embrace the wide sea, as we with our Maker united would be, as we with our Maker reunited would be. Come here while I sing you of emerald hills, of valleys and meadows so fair that all who have seen them have carried away memories in their hearts, friends, like the lilacs of May. Oh, my song is the story of the lilacs of May. Thank you. Okay. Did Today I would like to read you from this truly excellent book. Conversations with Yogananda was the subject for several years of a television program that I had in India. It went to 20 million homes every day of the year, and it was a great success. Unfortunately, I couldn't pay for it any longer because we decided to build an ashram near Pune and needed every spare penny we could get to finish that construction. Nonetheless, I've always had a very deeply fond spot in my heart for this particular book. Master told me repeatedly, write down my words, write down my words. And, you know, he gave me a very interesting blessing. I do have a good memory for words anyway. Usually I can remember them clearly as if people were still speaking them, but with this, in his case, it was to an extraordinary degree. I remember he was planning to take me to India, and for 3 years in a row we were to go. The last year was 1952, and he had already left his body. But I said to him one day, "Sir, I think I could easily learn Bengali." And he said, "Very easily." He said, "Chok, Nak, Hat, Muk, Kan." And he said it only once. I remembered them perfectly. When I got to Bengal, I was able to verify them. That was 8 years later. And there was a song he sang to us in Bengali, just once, but I remembered everything. Mukti dite pari, mukti dite pari, mukti dite pari, bhakti dite pari koi. I never saw the song written out. I never heard the words again, but they were so clearly etched in my memory that again, 8 years later, when I went to India, I was able to verify it, and I had it letter perfect. Somehow, the blessing he gave me enabled me to remember words that he had uttered even years earlier. And so this book really is not fiction at all. Every single word. Sometimes I've edited it. After all, you have to edit all books when they appear in writing, and even my own words I have to edit. Sometimes I'll go over a book 50 times before I'm satisfied. This book I hardly went through and edited at all. It was just, you might say, almost word for word, just as he said it. And this particular saying that I want to read today was, I think, a very precious bit of advice. If you go to a doctor and get a prescription from him, but after you return home you tear it up and toss it away, how will you expect to get well? The guru is your spiritual doctor. It isn't sufficient merely to have it, Guru. You must do what he tells you. If you follow his prescription even a little bit, your life will be transformed. Everyone who practices what he learns here will pass through the portals of death into the radiant kingdom of light. Don't expect to get there, however, if you merely depend passively on the guru, like a superstitious patient whom one may imagine framing his prescription and hanging it on a wall, as if expecting the writing itself to make him well. And don't think to get there by merely hanging on grimly to the end. Go on with steadfast faith, devotion, and joy. Long before you reach your divine goal, you will have realized how very sweet life can be when it is lived rightly. You will be glowing with inner radiance, vitality, and happiness. I've been following him now for 62 years. I'd been with him less than a year, only 8 months. I was still only 22. But he knew what my destiny was, and I knew where he was supposed to speak that next Sunday. It was San Diego, because it was my duty to send in the announcements to the churches saying who would be speaking where and when. And I knew that he was to speak in San Diego on that Sunday. And I knew it was the first time that they had seen him in 2 months. And I really understood how eager they must be to listen to him. And yet Saturday morning, one of the older ministers came to me and he said, "Master, can't go today, tomorrow. He wants you to go in his place. He wants you to give Kriya Yoga initiation to somebody." I had only been to one Kriya initiation in my life. I had never lectured in public in my life. I didn't know much of the teachings, but what little bit I did know, I think I covered in 5 minutes. But of course I went willingly enough and did my homework and tried to study and what to say and so on. What amazed me was how gracious people were. First of all, the way it was handled in those days were that the curtain was closed. And when the service began, the curtains opened and the minister was standing in the center of the stage greeting everybody. Well, people were expecting Master and they were eager to hear him. And the curtain opened and there was this young 22-year-old boy. And you could feel this wave of shock going through the entire audience. And was I nervous? Not at all. I was so sorry for those poor people out there who had to be subjected to me when they could listen to Master. But people were peering in the window. People were sitting outside with their ears, hands to their ears. The inside of the church was completely filled. Standing room only, standing room in the aisles, standing room at the back, a few people sitting on the floor in the front, and nobody got up and walked out. I thought, this is a sign of true graciousness. But you know, one thing that was also very interesting is that I've never been nervous about lecturing in public. First of all, because I never think of myself as teaching anyone. I'm only sharing with friends what little I know. And therefore, there's nothing to be nervous about. But another reason I've never been nervous is that I've always felt that whatever is. And if I'm a fool, what does it matter if everybody finds out about it? So what's to be nervous about? I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm just me. And it may be or may not be unfortunate, but I am me. And if you want to accuse me of bad grammar, do so, because it is. Okay. Okay, anyway. One thing I noticed in living with him was that there were many disciples who didn't take his words seriously. Thank God I asked him the question I did when I first met him. He accepted me immediately, which was unusual. I'd never heard of another case like that. And he said to me, I give you my unconditional love. And I thought, what a staggering gift that is. And he said, will you give me yours? And I said, yes. Then he said, will you give me your unconditional obedience? Well, I was desperate to be accepted, but I had to tell the truth. I could not begin on a false footing. And so I said, sir, what if I ever think you're wrong? Must have been a cheeky thing for a young 22-year-old to say to his guru, but I had to be honest. And he understood, and he didn't get offended or anything. I never saw him get offended. But he said, I will never ask anything of you that God himself does not tell me to ask you. So I said, in that case, sir, I give you my unconditional obedience. Thank God I said that. Thank God I was able to get that in the clear. Because from then on, whatever he said absolutely went. There were people who would come to him and hold up questions in their mind. Yes, one person, one boy said, well, I don't want to give my complete will to him. I've got my own will to consider. I thought, you're just being foolish. What is your will? It's got you into nothing but trouble. I know that I need help. I know that every mistake I've made has been due to ignorance. I need help. And I came to him because I knew he could give me the help I wanted. Therefore, let me shelve all my ideas as to what is right or wrong and just have the faith to see whether he won't lead me rightly. There was one pair of disciples. They weren't together in the sense of coming together, but they were fast friends. And Master said to them, actually what happened was that they had been coming down to Encinitas to see Master, and they had taken a bus down there. Master met them at the doorway, the gateway to Encinitas property. And he began scolding them for what they'd been talking about on the bus. He said, you've come here to talk about God. Don't talk about those things. He quoted to them word for word everything they'd said. Well, they didn't know what to say to answer that one. It was the plain truth. But then he said, don't mix with each other. And they thought, wasn't that cute of him to tell us that? They went on being friends just as if he'd never spoken. I've known other disciples who he would ask something of them and they would consider it to be perhaps beneath their dignity or I don't know what. But many times people would say, for example, you've got your own will. Why don't you follow? Why do you always do what he says? But I never saw that that will of theirs amounted to anything except self-will. He told us the story of Sister Ganamata, who we used to do everything he told her. And she, one time the disciples would say to her, well, why do you always follow what he says? Haven't you a will of your own? And she says, I'm sorry, but isn't it a little bit late to change? And I must say, I've never been so happy as I've been living with him. By following his will. Sometimes, I remember one time especially, I got very upset with him for asking something of me. I did it anyway, but I got very upset with him because I was much too intellectual. And he gave me the job of editing the magazine. And that was a purely intellectual job. And I thought, he's trying to get me to develop more devotion and then make me do all those things that have made devotion so difficult for me before, the tendency to reason everything out. And I wrote him a little note that same day that I'm sorry I had those thoughts. And he phoned me feigning not to know what I was talking about. He knew my every thought, but he said, I don't have no idea. Your letter makes no sense to me at all. So then I had to explain to him. He didn't explain back. All he said was, living for God is martyrdom. Well, that wasn't much of an answer to my mind. If I was to martyr just what I thought was the best thing for me. But he wanted me to obey him blindly if necessary, because you can't always figure everything out for yourself. But I did discover in time that keeping on with work that kept my intellect fresh and questioning did not harm my devotion at all. What he wanted me to do was develop a new quality without sacrificing my former talents, because I'd always had a good talent for arguing and everything. But I didn't have to sacrifice that. He wanted me developed in an equal and balanced way. So what I've learned is, because I've observed people over the years, those who accepted it provisionally, those who accepted his counsel and thought, well, yes, but let me weigh it in the balance. I, from the very beginning, clarified that issue. He had said, I will not ask anything of you that God does not tell me to ask you. And I took that on blind faith. And I found that it gave me clarity, not stupidity. He said that obedience to a guru will lead to liberation. The trouble afterwards was that his disciples thought obedience will lead you to liberation. I don't agree with that at all. I simply will not obey somebody who tells me something I consider wrong. I'm just as stubborn as a mule when it comes to trying to be told. I grew up in the days of the Nazis. I remember these friends of ours who were very nice people. They were Austrians. But before long, you began hearing them strutting about saying, we Germans will conquer the world. And I thought, what absolute bilge. But I did not agree with that. And my mother used to frequently try to get me to do things because it was the done thing. I would never do a thing just because it was the done thing. I drove them crazy with questions as to why this, why that. Mother went to Italy once on a vacation and wrote back and said that, tell the boys to be good, and that will make me happy and them happy. Don is sure to find a flaw in that argument, but you might try it on him. But I was, at heart, I had to know the reasons for everything. But I had straightened that one out with my guru from the very beginning. And I saw that those who went forward spiritually were those who did attune themselves. The important thing of having a guru is to attune yourself to his consciousness. It says in the Bible, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. To receive him does not mean signing on the dotted line and saying you're a Lutheran. It does not mean credo, I believe. It means receiving his consciousness into your own. There's a story Master told me on that subject. He said that there was a man who was being bothered by a demon. And he had read in the Shastras, the scriptures, that if you say a mantra into some powder and throw the powder on the demon, the demon will disappear or will stop being able to bother you. So he did this very elaborately. And when he finally got around to saying his mantra and throwing the powder, the demon just laughed at him. He said, before you could even say your mantra and into that powder, I myself got into the powder. So how could you touch me? The meaning of the story, many of those old stories are allegorical. The meaning of this is that how can you get rid of delusion by affirmation alone? The very mind that is affirming freedom is already locked in delusion. And the key has been thrown away Only the guru brings you that key. Otherwise, there's so many different ways of kidding yourself into thinking that this is a step toward freedom. I remember one day, I worked hard to become humble because I was intellectual and I was bright. And no one ever bested me in argument. And I could not help being somewhat proud of the fact. And I hated myself for that pride. I knew that it was a great obstruction on the spiritual path, but reasoning it out just didn't do it for me. But finally, I woke up one morning and realized again how the ego had slipped me into the same position all over again. And I found myself becoming proud of my humility. I used to joke, I'm the humblest person in Los Angeles and I want everyone to know it. But at least I had a sense of humor. I think maybe that was my salvation. But I remember one night, it was a very interesting night. I just had reached the point where I was so fed up with this argument in myself. And I just said, I'm so sick of this ego, get out! And I threw this thing as if it was a big burden onto the altar and just gave it all to Master. And I said, I refuse to think of it anymore. And all of a sudden, I felt great freedom. And I came out of my meditation room and I saw Master standing looking out over the tennis courts at Los Angeles. And as I knelt for his blessings and touched his feet as we did, he patted my forehead and he said, very good. But I've not had that problem since then. One time he was talking about how many ministers have fallen because of pride of the people the fact that people looked up to them and listened to them and so on. And I said, sir, that's why I don't want to be a minister. And he looked at the ground like this and he said, you will never fall due to ego. And he said it with great seriousness. Well, I found it to be true. People may call me egotistical all they like because I've done a lot of things in my life. And they may think that, well, that must make a person proud. It doesn't make me that at all. First of all, I don't feel I've done it. Secondly, I don't feel I exist. It's a very peculiar feeling, but I really don't. I'm just a sort of a phenomenon. Somebody who writes a book, but I don't write it. Who writes a song, and I don't write it. Who gives a lecture and doesn't feel he's given it. And all these things, you know, it's a very strange thing. The feeling of freedom that can come once you have followed the guru's instructions and don't go against this feeling inside that God really is the doer. I've laughed sometimes with you over that time that a woman in Hollywood Church complimented me for my talk. And I said to her, I said, God is the doer. She said, really? As if, well, I knew it was good. I didn't know it was that good. I said, that's not what I meant. I meant that he did it, I didn't do it. And if I made mistakes, then the mistakes are his, not mine. So you can blame him also. But I refuse to say I did it. And I really don't feel that I did it. You know, that's what that has done, and it's an amazing thing. I can do 10 times more by feeling that I'm not doing it at all. Isn't that odd? In other words, as long as that there's that burden, I'm doing it, there's the feeling of heavy responsibility for doing a good job. But when you have absolute freedom, then everything just flows. You know, my Mediterranean magic suite, I asked somebody once, how long do you think it took me to write it? There are songs on many different subjects, all somehow touching the Mediterranean. And she said, 2 weeks? I said, 1 hour. I don't know how, but I just passed from one song to the next to the next. And I had this question in my mind that when I came to Pompeii, I wanted to describe a town that had been destroyed by Vesuvius ashes. And I wanted to describe the tragedy of it. I wanted to describe the sin that must have caused that tragedy. I wanted to describe the fact that after all, this can't be that much of a tragedy now, after 2,000 years. Those souls have gone on elsewhere. All we're left now with the ashes and the ruins. But I just had these thoughts that I would like the song to say that. Then I said, give me a melody. Instantly it was there. And from there I passed to the next song. I was following a slideshow that I had put together. And the next song I wanted to show Napoli. And instantly a melody came that was a tarantella. La 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 la. And it went just completely different. The next one was cloisters. And how does cloisters begin? Long I've called you, my Lord. Long I've called you. It was a few photographs of a monastery. And I wanted to have the traditional Gregorian feeling, but I didn't say what I wanted it to do. I just said, well, let's do this traditional Gregorian feeling. And those melodies came, those notes came out. Long I've called you, my Lord. Long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your sight. You haven't really made a statement until you've repeated it at least once. Then I thought it's time to break out of that mode. And instantly the notes came. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. That note, tears, is out of the Gregorian mode. Then I wanted to bring it to modern times because after all, it's modern tourists who go to that monastery now. It's no longer a monastery. And so naturally the sort of training or influence to which I've been subjected would have been an emotional, how much longer, friend? Well, I knew that wouldn't do. So I said, let's rein it in. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? Hell, holding it in made it much more powerful. And then I thought, well, this song can't end on the tonic note. I am yours, ever yours, will you come? That would kill it. So I asked God, what should I do? And it ended just perfectly. I am yours, ever yours, will you come? And so the mood was just perfect. But you don't do these things on your own. This is where too many people, they want to be credited with being the composers, with being artists or writers and so on. I have sacrificed that praise by saying, quite frankly, I don't deserve it. And what I've gained is a decent song. When you think I'm doing it, you can't do a good job. He alone does everything in this universe. If you can give up the thought, I am the doer, it's not as if then you say, all right, you go, you take over God, I'm through with it. Then you become responsible for expressing him as truly as you can. You have to have a much higher level of awareness than if you were doing it just yourself. But I remember, because I was always sort of artistic and musical and I wanted to be a poet and a playwright and so on, but I could not for the life of me think of anything to say as long as I thought I was doing it. And when I met Master, I had to give up writing. I just said, what's the point of writing if I can't write truth? What's the point of flooding the world with my ignorance? And so I just quit writing. But after I met Master and he told me that you must write, then I said, sir, what can I possibly write? Haven't you said everything that's needed already? And he said, don't say that. Much more is needed. And so I took that as a charge. And, well, if I'd been in SRF, I'd never have been able to write anything. It would never have been published if I had written it. It was useless. The only book they published of mine was Stories of Mukunda, because they were stories about his childhood. At any rate, I found that by just turning it over to him and say, you do it, suddenly I could do just about anything. I really almost have the feeling that there isn't anything I couldn't do if I put my mind to God and asked him to give it to me. I admit that there are limitations. I'm a lousy carpenter, and I am quite persuaded of the fact, which at least to me is a fact, that I am a lousy carpenter. And that particular belief probably would prevent me from ever being a good carpenter. I remember when we were working on India Center, and I would hit a nail and miss it, and hit it again and miss it, and hit it about the 10th time, and finally hit it, and it would go, whoa. And then sort of a black cloud would come over my mind, and I'd think, this is hopeless. I just didn't have that particular skill. There are lots of things for which I have no skill at all. If I can't kick the tire of a car and get it running somehow, there's nothing else I know what to do. I just have to call the nearest mechanic. So, yes, we have our strengths and our weaknesses. Play on your strengths, but always ask God to do it through you. And have I ever asked people to be obedient to me? Not once. Not once. Master put me in charge of the monks. And in the tradition, the head monk always demands obedience of those who are under him. I said to them, I will not ask your obedience. All I will ask for is your cooperation. And I will follow you in anything you ask of me, as long as it doesn't go against my conscience or against our rule. But I have found that by obedience to truth, and in my guru I found that truth, I can't go wrong. And I want you to know that the monastic obedience that is usually asked of people is asked by ignorant people of other ignorant people. Obedience in itself is not good. Obedience to someone who is not wise will make you weaker in your will, not stronger. But if and when you find somebody who knows God, and I can say that I could ask people obedience now, but it has just become my habit, you might say. I don't like to. Nonetheless, when you go to a company, go to a job of any kind, and they expect you to do what they tell you to do, I would say, be enough of a rebel to ask yourself, is this right or is it wrong? You may be fired from job after job, but God will be on your side. He will take care of you. Don't be like those businessmen who think that the end justifies the means. There's only one way you can justify that statement, and that is to say that, yes, if you act right, then the results will be right. If you act wrong, the results will be wrong. In that way, in the end, every means is either justified or unjustified, not by what you expect, but by what the actual outcome is. If what you do ends in harmony, then it has to have been a good thing. If its results are beneficial, it will be a good thing. But it will not be a good thing just because you've won unscrupulously. this ethic of thinking that the end will justify whatever I'm trying to do. I'm giving a course very soon. It will be a course on how to achieve success, how to achieve lasting success. Really, the title will be 6 Weeks to Lasting Success and Happiness. And I think it'll be in some ways the most important course I could give. I have done many things in my life, and I hope I've done them well. I've written 140 books. Mind you, I am not boasting, but I've written 140 books. I've written over 400 pieces of music. I've started 8 communities where about 1,000 people now live. I've given thousands of talks around the world in 5 different languages. I've done many things that could qualify me for giving this course, because I know what works and what does not work. I do really urge all of you to take it, because I think it's perhaps the most important thing I can offer right now in my life. It is also based on a course that I wrote in India, but it's too Indian there, so I want to rewrite it and make it Western for Americans and for Westerners. But what prompted me was this. I was in the hospital in India. I had double pneumonia, and I was lying in bed practically unconscious when a doctor came into my room, and he said, "Sir, can you help me?" Well, you know, that's not the normal question for a doctor. Especially of a patient who's hardly able to open his eyes. And he said, "I have a son in college in Canada." And he said, "I have many responsibilities, but how can I always meet my responsibilities and meet my financial needs without bending the rules a little bit?" And I, from my position of absolute non-advertisement of anything positive, was able to mumble, "I have found that by doing what was right, I was always successful." Well, he walked away quite unconvinced, because I did not speak convincingly. And so the next day, when Leela brought me my lunch — Leela cooks for me, and she brought me my lunch — and the hospital fortunately turned a blind eye to her doing so, and I said, "Leela, I need to write a correspondence course on how to achieve success and happiness through yoga principles." And it took me 1.5 years to write that course. The afternoon when Keshava came — he used to be my secretary — and he came and took care of me while Leela went to our ashram to cook me dinner. And I said, "Keshava, get yourself a pen and some paper." And I dictated the whole first lesson and dictated the outline of all 26 lessons. There was so much to say. I had thought, surely I'll begin to peter out after a while. The last lesson is the longest of all, as I tried to get everything in that I possibly could that I hadn't yet said. The subject is an infinite one, but I really think it's the outward aspect of Kriya Yoga. It teaches people how to live a dharmic, spiritual life, bringing them true happiness in this world of so much confusion. But I wrote that book for India with many Indian references and so on. I want to rewrite the lessons more also for Americans. But I do think it's a very good course. And I'm excerpting from those 26 lessons, which amount to a book of about 600 pages. And I'm going to try to make a course out of it here in 6 weeks. Wish me luck. But I hope that you two will be a part of that group, because I think now we are coming, have almost arrived at a very serious depression. I think that people won't have the money to eat with. People will be suffering very widely. In India, Bhrigu Prophecy said to me, in the future in his country, when there will be weeping in every home, I think we're coming to that kind of a depression. Yogananda said, it will be much, much worse than the depression of the 1930s. And so I think we have to prepare ourselves for very serious times. What will happen with such a depression? Probably world war. I go to some countries and I feel the vibrations of war there still. Germany, I wouldn't go near, because I feel that there's going to be a terrible catastrophe happening there. Anyway, I don't have time now, because I'm supposed to let you ask me questions. So let me offer you that opportunity now. And with these few words, then, let me say that when you and if you accept a true guide, then follow him and don't think how cute he was to say such and such. And when he gives you a prescription, don't hallow it, hang it on the wall and treat it like a holy shrine. Treat it like a very, very serious advice, something which may not always look to you as the best path out of delusion, but if you follow him, it will take you out of delusion. So anyway, questions. And because I'm deaf as a post, I must ask Jyotish to come up here and help me out. The advice I try to give everybody is don't get old. Nobody listens to me. Okay. Yes.
Swamiji, you said something once similar to the fact that, I think it was you, maybe it was a quote from Yogananda, I don't remember, that I get everything confused after a while, that our guru is with us for all eternity. Is that correct?
She's asking, is our guru with us for all eternity?
You have different gurus along the way, but there is one Satguru. Sat means truth. He is the person who has been designated by God. It's his job, and he takes it willingly, to stay with you for incarnations until you find the divine. Sometimes you will be drawn to him through somebody like me, because he's left his body. He's still there. I remember there was this one disciple of Master who betrayed him terribly and nearly destroyed his work. Master used to send him mangoes every year, and he would send them back unopened. He was an Indian who loved mangoes, but so great was his distress with his guru that he wouldn't even accept that gift and wanted to hurt Master. Master said he will never find God except through this instrument appointed to him by God himself. So one time, Mr. Cuaron, our center leader in Mexico City, Master said to him, I lost sight of you for a few incarnations, but now I will never lose sight of you again. And every now and then, Mr. Cuaron would remind him, he said, sir, remember your promise. Master said, no, I never will lose sight of you again.
The second part of my question is, I don't know if I'm kind of directing it for myself or to you, but prior to coming to the ashram, prior to becoming initiated by Master, Could you have felt, in retrospect, his influence through the years before you actually met him?
In retrospect, did you feel Master's influence in your life before you actually met him?
I did not, and yet I always knew there was something, because everything seemed to work out in the right way for me. For example, a very wonderful example, I had reached the point of knowing that I absolutely needed help. I just could not get out of this quagmire that I found myself in, of not knowing how to get rid of this quality or develop that quality. And I absolutely needed him. But if I had gone to him or tried to go to him after reading Autobiography of a Yogi, if my parents had been living with me then, I could not have gone. It was too complete and sudden a step for me. I had never heard of Hinduism before. I'd never heard of gurus or yoga or any of the terms that are so common nowadays. I'd never heard any of them. I knew that I wanted truth, but I didn't know where to find it. And yes, I had heard of the Bhagavad Gita a few months or a few weeks before I read Autobiography of a Yogi. But what happened was this, that my father was sent to Egypt by his company, which was Exxon, Esso in those days. And he was sent as the exploration manager, as the oil geologist. He became the chief geologist for Europe. And he went there. It was a useless exercise for him. Although he found oil, although he knew oil existed, where they did find it, Mobile Oil found oil just where my father had said they would find it. But Esso just decided it's useless being in Cairo and pulled him out. So it was, in a sense, a useless exercise for him to go to Cairo. But for me, it was an essential exercise. He was not on the scene. The very day I put my mother on the ship to go join him was when I found Autobiography of a Yogi. Imagine the timing. If she had been there, if either of them had been there, or both of them even worse, I don't think I'd have had the strength to get on that next bus. I read the autobiography. I took the next bus across the country. I said to him words I'd never imagined saying to anybody. But I said, "Sir, I want to be your disciple." And he accepted me that day. And I've been his disciple now for 62 years, over 62 years. Could any of this happen had they been in the country? I have to frankly say that, fortunately, that decision does not have to be made. It was not possible. They were too far away to do anything about it. People couldn't jump on planes in those days. And I think that was just one example. He gave me just the right roommates. Everything in my karma pushed me in this direction. And even being born in Romania and growing up in Europe, although my parents were from Oklahoma, everything fitted together to bring me the right kind of education, to bring me the right understanding. Being in Europe when the Nazis were becoming strong, so many influences. I have to say that I think he had a hand in it. Okay? Any other questions? Yes.
Hi, Swamiji. My question is, in terms of the population of the planet Earth and all the new human beings that are being born, where are all of the souls and consciousness coming from of other people?
in terms of the population of the earth and all of the new souls that are being born, where are all those souls coming from?
You think about this little mud ball of something? There's this life everywhere in space. Most recently, science has been discovering that there are many suns with planetary systems like our own. The chances of life being elsewhere are more than theoretical. There are just too many stories that must be true of people who are truthful people who have had experiences with UFOs. This universe is full of life, and you could be on many, many different planets, probably have been. I asked Master one time, what about all the souls who are here now? Will they be coming back in Satya Yuga when man is much more enlightened? He said, oh no. He said, otherwise people don't keep coming back to the same planet. And he said, rather a ruin-inspiring, is that the right expression? Makes you feel rueful to consider. He said, otherwise they would find out too soon. So is God actually trying to keep us from finding out? In a way he is. He's got a double game going on here. But what he doesn't want is for us not to seek him with our own sincerity. So he throws obstacles in the way so that we may have to use our discrimination to know that this must be true and not to be told by the very fact that we begin to remember this earth having come back here so many times. No, there are many, many planets you yourself have lived on and will continue to live on. And when there's a plethora of people on one planet, I mean just one or two from different planets elsewhere. The question is a useless one when you consider the vastness of this universe. Any other questions? Yes.
Strengthen our own attunement with Master. What would you recommend for each of us?
What would you recommend today for us to strengthen our own attunement with Master?
I would say, first of all, be close to a disciple of his. My function is to bring people to him. But his function also is not to bring people to himself. We're all in this game together trying to bring everybody to themselves. And that is the God within you. So if you listen to me, you will get some idea of what it is to be, what it was to be with Master. But that's not enough. You'll get a deeper and deeper understanding of who you are. And that's what the real thing is all about. It's not personalities. It's infinite and absolute truth. You wanted to ask another question. Did you?
Yep.
I misunderstood you.
No.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to know, and I'm researching this myself, what will be the safest place on earth once the depression starts? And where will you be staying?
Desire. And what?
What is the safest place on earth once the depression starts, and what is the reason?
The country where you can grow your own food. That means a little distance from Los Angeles, I'm afraid. But the most important thing you can do in a time of depression is to buy land, have land, and use it to grow your own food. Many people will say, buy gold. Well, in Germany in 1923, when they had the hyperinflation, people were selling gold for food. Food is the essential thing in life. And if you can grow your own food, then you will be leagues ahead of the game. Now then, Can you do it alone? Some people can. If I went out there, the plants would all die. I remember I lived in this monastery, Catholic monastery, for 6 months after I was thrown out of SRF. And I looked out the window of my cell and there was just barren ground. So I thought with great glee as I drove past a garden place, I bought a flat of pansies. I felt so self-righteous buying these pansies to help make that garden beautiful. Jyotish, I need help here.
Okay.
And I looked out the window 2 months later. There the pansies were in their flat, all dead. I'm just a hopeless gardener, and I'm a hopeless carpenter, and a hopeless mechanic. But I am good at a few things, and there are other people who are good at mechanics and carpentry who are not good at the things that I am good at. And thus it is that you see that most people are not completely self-sufficient. Almost everybody needs people along with them. In fact, man is a social animal, and man enjoys the company of man. I would say that if you do get land, do it with other people. Or join Ananda. We already have land. Help to join a community movement that I think will change the face of the earth. I think it will be a new style of living in this world. Not huge cities like these. I think they're going to be bombed out of existence. But I think land where people can live in small communities, where they know each other, where they can help each other. At Ananda, when a couple want to get married, everybody pitches in to help them have a good honeymoon or whatever it might be. Somebody goes to the hospital. There are lots of people who go and help them there, help them with expenses, visit them. Ananda is actually a jewel in this world. We're one of the least advertised jewels around, but we're really, it's a wonderful place. But I don't say you must join Ananda. This is a movement that will spread of its own power as people come to see the importance of it. You all who have had a little bit advance notice, I really urge you, I could not urge you anything more seriously than this. Get land in the country. Land where you can grow your own food and live simply and not have to live up to all the expectations of people's that people have of their appearance. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, there's one here.
Okay. Will it become more difficult to attune oneself to master when there no longer are any living disciples?
What's that?
Will it become more difficult to attune oneself to master when there are no longer any living disciples?
Of course it will be, but there's a wave of change, and they will find others in this work who are inspiring to them. And remember, it isn't master the man. He represented a principle, and that principle you can't kill. That principle will continue. There will, on this path, continue to be inspiring people that others will say on seeing them, well, I would like to be like that too. They will be able to help them. By the way, your question in your letter, which I found interesting, he thought that maybe I had not wanted to study Greek was because I had bad memories of being in Greece. The truth is I had bad memories of being in college. I didn't like college. I didn't like its approach to truth. And it was that I was really rebelling against. Otherwise, Greece itself has always had very pleasant associations in my mind. And I remember, because I lived in Romania, it was easy for us to go to Greece, and at the age of 7, I went there, and I remember standing in the marketplace and seeing where by devotees, brought the news from Macedonia. Is that the right? Marathon. I don't remember all the stories now, but I was absolutely fascinated by the old myths. Many of those myths are deep symbols. So for all these things, I have to say that there are no associations with Greece in my mind that are unpleasant. Rather, quite the contrary. But thank you for your letter. It would have been one theory. It's just that it wasn't Greek I was against. It was college. Okay, any other? Yes.
Hello.
Well, this poor fellow's been having his hand up.
Thank you.
Let him have his chance.
Thank you. Yes, I can be heard. Okay. I fully understand the importance of finding the divine consciousness. And in that note, where are the living masters, or if you would, where are the Yoganandas of today?
That's a good question. But because I don't have the answer doesn't mean there isn't one. There are plenty of great masters living in the world, some of them living concealed lives. I would say go to that person who inspires you and he will lead you. Master said God guides you first through books, then through teachers, and finally he himself. You don't have to look for them. He himself will guide you to that person. I heard a story which was told to me as true, and I have no reason to doubt it, of a young man who went up to the mountains and took a cabin and decided to spend his life seeking God. And one day he went out for a walk, and when he came back, he found a man from India seated in front of his house. And he said, I've come to help you. God had sent him. And he stayed with this man and followed him for a while. And then one day he came home from another walk and he found a woman of great beauty. And she was so beautiful and fitted so well all his desires from feminine beauty that he made love to her. And she disappeared, and she never came again, and he fell from the path. These things happen. There's a strange world we're living in. But in this case, God answered his prayer, and then Satan tempted him to see if he could stand it, and he wasn't able to. He just said, well, for this life I'm lost, but I know I will find it again someday. So wherever you are, God will come to you as your need is great. My need was desperate, and so God arranged it that I meet Master without the impediment of my parents. Okay? There's somebody behind you now who had that right.
Hello. I would like to ask, what advice would you give to one who has fallen in a deep depression, and how can one help another to lift oneself up of that depression?
What advice would you give to someone who's fallen into a deep depression, and what advice would you give to someone to help another person who has fallen into a depression?
It's a very difficult advice to give because, you see, we are living in a world where there are influences. We don't live uninfluenced. Master said in Autobiography of a Yogi, our very thoughts are universally, not individually rooted. And they change according to the level of consciousness we're on. For a person who is in a depressed state, to give him solid reasoning may work, but the chances are very strongly against it. What can you do? You can give him a positive influence. You can surround him with positive influences. But be careful that you don't get pulled down in the process. And that can happen. A strong magnet will always influence a weaker magnet. So make sure that your own magnetism is strong. But the trouble is that when you're focusing on somebody who's depressed, you're focusing also on his depression, and that can pull you down. People often will just have to go down and down until they decide they've gone far enough and have suffered enough and they don't like it, and then they themselves will turn around. But how to help people? Naturally, you want to help them if you can. Try not reasoning, because reasoning can always be turned towards supporting the heart. So try to take them out of themselves. Do things for fun. Go out for jogs by the beach, maybe. Do things physically entertaining. Energizing, perhaps, is a better word to use here. And see that he is surrounded as much as possible by positive people. The tendency of a depressed person is to want to be alone. Try to force him into the company of more cheerful people. These are difficult things to say, but I would say antidepressants are only a temporary means. They can't work for long. It's a very serious situation these days. We're going to have it much, much more. When people see no hope, they can't get jobs, there are no jobs available, it won't be easy. We must do our best to be forces of light. That's the best I can say. Okay? Well, it is nearly 12:30, but I have time for at least one question. And if it's a short question, and I can give a short answer, then we have time for two questions.
Could this depression and world war be avoided? Any chances?
Can depression and world war be avoided? Any chances?
There was a time when I might have said yes. I don't think that it can be avoided now. You're talking of economic depression now. You know, you reach the point where when a boat develops 10 times the amount of cargo it was designed to hold, it's not very easy to say, well, positive thinking should help it to keep it afloat. Thoughts don't have the same power. I would say that at this point, it is not possible. Ideally, yes, love would do it. Generosity, kindness, service to one another. All these things are good. What I think they can really do, though, only, is create a little island of safety for yourself. When you have the right attitude, a giving attitude instead of a taking attitude, a wish to help and cooperate, rather than compete and destroy, then you will find, you know, when the bomb fell on Hiroshima, there were many people who unaccountably were called out of town. Another even more interesting fact is that there was a community of people in the heart of town who were a spiritual community, and they were untouched. Even by all the devastation around them, they themselves were not touched by it. So remember when the Master said that those who love God will be protected, he was not speaking idly. If you love God, you will not be touched by these things. Will your love be enough to offset the massive lack of love in this world? That seems hardly likely. But everything is possible. At this time, my opinion is that Jesus himself couldn't change things. I think they are going to go a certain way. But you can at least make a better world for yourself. When in Cairo, there was some big uprising of Muslims and everything, my parents were only a block away, and yet they were unaffected by it. So these things depend very much on the kind of radiation you put out harmonious and giving vibrations, and you should be able to go safe everywhere. No time for more questions. So God bless you. I'll be waiting for you in the lobby. Bye-bye.